You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Lawrence Rinder. He is the director of the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive. Larry, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Larry, tell me a little bit about the Berkeley Art Museum. I know you've been there for a while. I'd like to know what's going on now there and how you see the program of that museum developing or how it has developed. Mm-hmm.
Well, we are the Visual Arts Museum of UC Berkeley, and we are unique in that our institution, both in terms of the collections and the programs, is about half film of the cinematic variety and half visual art of the gallery variety. And in both of those areas of our collection program, we're virtually encyclopedic. So we're not just involved with contemporary film and art. Our collections go back in the film side to the beginnings of cinema. We have a very big collection of silent films and films from all over the world, from all periods. And similarly in art, we go back to about 2000 BC and up to the present. So our collections and programs are very, very broad. Although we are the museum of UC Berkeley, our attendance is only about 30% UC Berkeley staff, faculty, and students. So we do play a very important hinge role between the university and the surrounding communities.
And the Pacific Film Archive, that is the archive that's within the Berkeley Art Museum that you were just mentioning?
Right. So we are a single institution, the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive. It's one thing. And, way, way back in ancient history, in the mid to late 60s, the PFA was briefly an autonomous organization on campus. But as of, I think, 1971, it was fully ensconced at the as part of the what was then called the University Art Museum.
Wow. So the Pacific Film Archive is what I don't know that well, and I want to talk about the museum too, but that sounds enormously broad. How many films are there, and how do you manage a collection like that? Like how do you determine what's brought in or not brought
right.
in?
Yeah, so we have about 17,000 films and videos, and the storage and preservation of that collection is a pretty enormous task in its own right. There's not enough attention, in my opinion, being given to the preservation of film. It's clearly an enormously important part of our cultural heritage or patrimony, as the French would say, and yet every year, in fact, probably every month and every day, films disappear completely from the record, the historical record, because of decay and so on. So we are very actively involved, along with our sister archives around the world, in preserving as many films as possible and improving our storage. Film is ideally stored at a low temperature, but we have so many films that our film storage area is about the size of a football field. It's difficult and expensive to keep it at an ideally cool temperature. So we're always trying to improve in that regard. On the programmatic side, we have almost 400 screenings a year, and in all the areas that are covered by our collection, although only about 10% of the films that we show are from our own collection. So we are borrowing all the time from other archives around the world, and we participate in a number of film festivals, the San Francisco International Film Festival, the African Film Festival, and so on. We have a staff of currently two full-time curators who create original film series. One of the programs we have up now is our Georgian film series, films from the Republic of Georgia, about almost 100 years of cinema. Georgia has a very rich history in film production, going back to the silent era and up to the present, that has really been very little seen in the United States. So the series that was organized by Susan Oxtoby, our senior film curator, was shown simultaneously last fall at MoMA in New York and at the BAMPFA, and continues here throughout the rest of the year. It's also now at the National Gallery in New York. So our film programs do tour nationally and internationally.
Wow. I mean, one thing that you bring up that to me is always sort of extraordinary, and I need help in understanding how the preservation of it works, because I remember when I went to the Donnell Library not long ago in New York, which seems also to have a pretty amazing archive, and mm-hmm. I was looking for a French film, Cinema Verite, called Chronicle of a Summer. Mm-hmm. And it was never put to video, and apparently they have it. I went there, and they said, oh, yeah, we'll pull it out of storage, cold storage, come back mm-hmm. tomorrow. Yeah, there's not many copies of it, apparently. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing, yeah. LaRouche film at Cinema Verite, and then they just give it to me. I sit in a mm-hmm. small room, and I'm running this thing through a 16-millimeter projector on my own.
Yeah.
I was excited as I was horrified.
Yeah,
but
no, that sounds
I'm destroying the film right now.
Right. Yeah.
And then I went back there. I found they had early Duchamp films. Same thing.
Yeah.
They're giving me the original 16-millimeter Duchamp film, and by myself in a little room, I'm running it through a 16-millimeter projector and probably scratching it. Not that I don't know how to operate one, but
Yeah, that I think those protocols are probably not quite the same level as ours. We do try to make our films and videos accessible to the public. People can by appointment. You know, researchers come and screen works that are not part of the public programs, but that is all done with very careful assistance from professional projectionists and whatnot. We are seeking to digitize more and more of our films so that people can view them without having to access and potentially damage the celluloid version. Interestingly, while digitization is an important step to increase accessibility of films and videos, historic films and videos, it's not currently considered, I think, by most people, although there's probably some difference of opinion, to be the ideal archival medium. Right now, celluloid is actually considered a more stable archival medium than digital, in part because of the lack of time that has passed with digital medium that hasn't proven itself to be stable. So celluloid has its problems. One of the weird things about it is there's a contagious disease called vinegar syndrome that can be passed from film to film, and sometimes if you go into a film archive and you smell something vinegary, there's a film with vinegar syndrome there. So there's weird things about celluloid, but in balance, it's considered a more stable archival medium. But as it becomes rarer and rarer, you ideally, as an archive, would not want the general public just sort of handling and screening their own films.
Right, and you said some films disappear on a regular basis. What does that mean? Because of
Things like vinegar syndrome, for example. You imagine you've got some early silent film of which maybe there's only one copy left, and there's probably thousands of examples of that. If the one that's left gets vinegar syndrome and it hasn't been digitally preserved, it's gone. That's it. It's over. That film will never be seen again.
My gosh, that's so upsetting. What I don't understand is why can't they all just be, even though digitization, it's true, it doesn't hold out the same. You can't really say that this will last for 35 or 100 years. Wouldn't it be better than nothing that we'd have some kind of document of that film?
It would be better than nothing, and we are doing it ourselves as fast as possible. For us to go out sort of commercially and to have a film digitized, it costs, I think I'm right in saying, probably several thousand dollars, maybe even as much as $5,000 or $6,000 for a film, if not more, because you're not just sort of putting it on a machine and letting it run. You have to color correct. You have to really pay attention to all kinds of quality issues as the thing is running. So it's a labor-intensive process, and we just haven't been able to afford to do that many of our films. We are about to invest, if all the stars align, in some equipment that will enable us to digitize in-house, which will be a huge thing for us. It'll really make it possible for us to work much more quickly, to maintain the quality standards that are so important to us in-house. So hopefully beginning sometime next year, we will be doing our own collection digitization of the films.
Well, that's good to hear. Tell me a little bit about the Berkeley Art Museum then. You also have this vast archive, you know, from 2000 BC to now seems about as fast as it could be. How do you organize shows, and what's the,
right,
the curatorial program there? What,
yeah,
what you've done so many kind of interesting breakout shows with kind of fascinating themes, mm-hmm, political and otherwise. How are you participating in the vision there? And
yeah,
what is it?
Right. So in many ways, we're a typical American university art museum in that you know, we do have an encyclopedic collection, not unlike in form, if not the exact character, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, that sort of thing. It's the same, you know, it was formed in a way with the same spirit of being a place where students and others could enjoy examples as excellent as possible of various periods of art. We were started much more recently than Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. Our museum was founded in 1963, so the depth and breadth of our collection is not as much as, you know, our East Coast peers, but nevertheless, it is quite extraordinary. And there are some areas where we are as good as any university museum, or indeed any museum of any kind. One of those areas is abstract expressionist painting. This institution was founded by Hans Hofmann, who gave the money to build the building we're in now. And 45 paintings that, you know, and we now have 50 of his paintings that form, I believe it's the largest collection of Hofmann paintings in a public institution. On the heels of that foundation, the first director, Peter Seltz, was able to get some extraordinary gifts from people like Ad Reinhardt, who gave a black painting. We subsequently got gifts from Clifford Still, Helen Frankenthaler. In the 90s, when I was a curator here, someone gave us a 1950 Pollock drip painting. So we have a great ABEX collection, really first rate. Some other areas where we excel are as good as anyone include Ming and Qing Dynasty Chinese painting. We were very lucky to be the museum of the university that employed James Cahill, who was for many decades really the leading scholar of Chinese historical art. And he collected, since the 50s and 60s, amassed a really extraordinary collection of Chinese ink painting and gave quite a number of extremely significant pieces to us, and we now have a fantastic collection. We've just acquired, and last fall we acquired the Stephen Lieber Conceptual Art Collection. Stephen was an amazing person, a pioneering collector and educator of conceptual art and artist-designed ephemera, so art, things like artist-designed posters and invitations and things like this. He passed away very prematurely a couple years ago, and we were able to acquire his really world-class collection of conceptual art, probably almost 1,000 pieces, amazing pieces representing all of the key figures of conceptual art, as well as a lot of, lesser-known people internationally, as well as his library. So we will have in the new building the Stephen Lieber Conceptual Art Study Center, as well as an Asian Art Study Center, Works on Paper Study Center, and our Film Library and Study Center. So we're about, that introduces the fact that we're about to move to a new building. You asked sort of what was up with our on the museum side. We are leaving the building we're in currently because it's seismically unsound, and in 4 months we'll move to a new building in downtown Berkeley that is designed by Diller Scofidio Renfro. In that new building, we will bring the art and film sides of our programming back together. They've been in separate buildings for about the past 10 years, and we will increase by about 5 times the amount of space dedicated to collection access, so people will, through these study centers and so on, be able to enjoy works of art and film that even if they're not on view. So we're really looking forward to that, and it's something that has been incredibly preoccupying for me for the past 6 years or so since I've been the director, is bringing this new design to fruition, raising the money, and getting us moved over safe and sound.
Wow. So how many square feet will that be, or what kind of space is that? That sounds like it'll be a gorgeous design, of course. Great architect.
Yeah, great architects. I've loved working with them. They're incredibly ingenious. The new building is about 83,000 gross square feet, and we'll have about 26,000 square feet for exhibitions, two film theaters, one that's 230 seats, another that's 33 seats, and lots of spaces for, as I said, study centers, but also, you know, an art lab for drop-in art making and all kinds of other sort of strange ancillary spaces for unpredictable activities. We chose Dealers Cafeteria Renfro in part because of their prior experience working with pre-existing structures, both the High Line and Lincoln Center, which they did the major redesign of a few years ago.
Right, Lincoln Center is fantastic.
That's fantastic.
Such a great redesign.
Yeah, they did an amazing job. And our project involves the repurposing of an existing 1939 printing plant that was the printing plant for UC Berkeley. That's smack in the middle of downtown Berkeley and was essentially abandoned, not abandoned, but it was not occupied for many years. It's an incredible piece of real estate opposite the main entrance to the campus and a block from the downtown, what we call the BART train, the subway. So really centrally located, huge industrial space with north-facing skylights, sort of along the lines of Dia Beacon, but more elegant, actually. It's a deco-moderne building, so it's got these deco touches to the design. And Dealers Cafeteria Renfro, more or less doubled the square footage of that building with some very innovative new architectural interventions. And, it's taking shape right now. We're 4 months from completion.
Wow. That's exciting. So now I have a sense of the breadth and depth of this, both collections and what's happening there, which is pretty huge. As a curator, now you have this vast historical archive and contemporary archive at your fingertips. How do you approach that in terms of curating and themes? Well, is that how you're thinking now? What I know of you from the Whitney and all the shows you did at the Whitney and right around that time, you were pulling works and soliciting younger artists, older artists, and kind of setting forth a certain agenda of your own, if you will, or correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And how is that happening now, or is that happening now? Is your role more historical? I'm trying to understand what your vision is now.
So, first of all, I'm the director now, so I have a staff of professional curators, Apsara DeQuinzio, Lucinda Barnes, and then film curators Susan Oxtoby and Kathy Garrett, who all do a fantastic job. They're working constantly developing programs from all periods, and also Julia White is our senior curator for Asian art, does incredible, groundbreaking historical Asian art exhibitions. So it's wonderful to have a staff of great colleagues, but I am still curating on top of all this other stuff that I'm working on. So I will be and am organizing the opening exhibition for the new building. And for that show, I wanted to do something that marked the occasion of new architecture without necessarily being an architecture show. So I wanted to draw attention to the new building, but also in a way to the spirit of architecture and the potency of architecture as a concept and as a kind of a resonant metaphor. And another one of my goals was to do a show that reflected our position as part of a great university and to gesture towards and embrace that kind of multidisciplinary character of the university, at the same time drawing attention to the fact that our museum is a, quasi-encyclopedic museum and not just modern and contemporary. So the show I'm doing is called Architecture of Life, and it's art, architecture, and scientific illustration going back 1,000 years from all different continents and countries and cultures. All of which is united by the ways in which the works use architecture, and in many ways metaphorically, to explore the fundamental nature of reality, of the psyche, the structure of society, and whatnot. So it's a little bit open-ended and poetic, but there are some incredible treasures, I would say, that will be in this exhibition, including original drawings by the founder of modern neuroscience, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, from the late 19th century to 17th century Tibetan mandalas to a film by Kenneth Anger from 1950 to, you know, just very wide-ranging. So it is also art and film. It will include some examples of a film. And it's taking up the whole museum, so it's a kind of a major undertaking.
That's fascinating. It's I love that theme about architecture and the way it influences the whole world. I remember reading a book called A Pattern Language.
Yes, that's a Berkeley book, Christopher Alexander.
Is it just a gorgeous book? That was kind of like a Bible to me for a while.
For many people, that was an extremely influential text. Yeah.
And is that part of the kind of ethic of that? I remember in reading that. The way it talked about architecture influencing space and vice versa, and how we change the space or can kind of remold the architecture in a way by the way we're living in it.
Right.
It is
related, definitely. Right as of now, Christopher Alexander's work is not part and parcel of the show, although that could change. I'm still... have just a little under a year to pull it all together. Some of the architects whose work is represented, obviously Diller Scipio Renfro, Frederick Kiesler, who is a great visionary kind of anti-modernist of the mid-20th century, Lebius Woods, Toyo Ito, and some others. But Christopher Alexander is definitely a potent force, and someone who's I should look at that work.
So, Larry, I know you had your BA from Reed College and Hunter, and you know, began doing a lot of writing, also novels, poetry, fiction. Then you did the Whitney Biennial, of course, which is where I know you. But between the Whitney Biennial and where you are now, I'm curious about what was happening creatively, and are you still writing, or are there other fields? I know you're a busy guy and all over the place. It sounds like your plate is full as director, I imagine. Doing all kinds of things. Are you writing, and are there other things that are also happening?
I did have a brief interlude, I guess you could call it, in my museum career, hiatus, after I left the Whitney in 2004. I went back to the California College of the Arts, and I was the dean of the college for a period. And that stint as an academic administrator was very inspiring for me. In part because it opened my practice to areas that were outside of the fine arts, narrowly speaking. So I got to interact on a daily basis with architects and designers and writers, and that way of working and living and thinking is just much more suited to my temperament. So I was at CCA as a dean for 4 years, and then came to BAM PFA as the director. And indeed, I am working all the time on this job. I do a little bit of writing, relatively little. I occasionally will do a text for an artist whose work I love. I do what I think are interesting but probably highly inaccurate translations of French poetry, but that's just like my weekend thing. I mean, you were asked about kind of my creative outlets. That's kind of where I'm getting my personal creative pleasure right now is in translation. And I, over the past 4 years, I've been working with a group of friends to hand-build a kind of a 9th-century Japanese farmhouse. That's a wonderful project that's coming to a conclusion soon.
Hand-build a 9th-century? Tell me a little bit about that. That sounds amazing. How are you doing that?
Well, there's a fellow out here who's really a great person and a really inspired teacher named Paul Disco, and he's an expert in Japanese joinery and traditional Japanese construction techniques. And he's been working with a group of me and my friends and myself on the design and construction of a. It's not. It's sort of, when I say 9th century, it's a pre-modern Japanese farmhouse style building that actually we've adapted to our contemporary lives. It is going to function as a kind of a one-room schoolhouse. So it has a classroom, a bedroom for a teacher, and a library. And it's all the wood is salvaged wood from an old chicken barn that we tore down, and trees that fell down in the Berkeley Hills and whatnot. And the walls are made of bamboo that's been sort of laced together and then covered with clay from the land that I own up in Mendocino County. So it's been an incredible project, but a really wonderful balance. I mean, I've been done that building at the same time that I've been working on this Diller Scofidio Renfro thing, and so it's these two poles of architecture, one in which it's, you know, very theoretical and urban and big, and the other very rural and visceral and small.
And what will happen to that little farmhouse? Will it be a schoolhouse? And
I hope so. Yeah.
Or?
There's no program that really for it. It's just there, and I anticipate that people will come there and teach classes probably just on weekends, and it'll be a place for something to happen. But the building was its own purpose, and it's been a great deal of fun.
And you said when you moved to California or went there that it kind of suited your temperament more. Can you tell me a little bit about that? It doesn't have to be personal, but the difference between that kind of position in New York at the Whitney, I would imagine that was kind of extraordinary for what it was, and in California, which is what, a completely different.
It's completely different. So when I was talking about that temperamental thing before, I was talking really more about being the dean at CCA professionally, and the fact that CCA is an art school with art, architecture, design, you know, literature, criticism, fine art. So I just tend to, I love art, and that really is the focus of my work. But I see it in a very broad and integrated cultural context, and not just sort of art on its own. And I feel like in some ways the art world in New York is a little bit too siloing of the disciplines. There's not as much just culturally speaking, and the informal culture of New York. And also the formal culture, I think, in the museums, not enough or that as much as there could be a kind of conversation among disciplines. I think in the Bay Area, maybe because it's the scale of the place, or maybe it's because of the existence of schools like CCA that comes out of, you know, a Bauhaus arts and crafts tradition of integrating disciplines across art and design, that's just more part of the daily formal and informal culture here is that kind of interdisciplinarity. And so I do enjoy that here. I certainly love living in California. It's 75 degrees and sunny. I love it.
It's been freezing here constantly with an endless amount of snow. That's really very interesting. How do you see artists? I mean, lastly, just to talk about the young artist scene there, that's a different context to kind of graduate school in and emerge in. Do you see a different type of artist, more interdisciplinary, happening there, or is there a different kind of movement there as opposed to New York?
Yes, I do think so. Especially over the past 10 years or so, I think there has been among younger artists a very, very strong embrace of this kind of multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary approach to art making, or culture making, we could call it. We did an exhibition here it was spring of 2014 called The Possible, which was organized by a local artist, David Wilson, that really was a kind of an embodiment of this kind of practice. and people can look that up online. It was called The Possible, organized by David Wilson. You know, the thing that's going on right now in the Bay Area, and time will tell how what its significance is because of the tremendous economic boom in the tech world. There's a demographic transformation taking place that has really made it extremely difficult for younger artists to stay and live in San Francisco. Many of the San Francisco folks have moved to L.A. or to the East Bay, which is where Berkeley is. I think that boom is going to impact the East Bay, where I am, and it is already. But and it may make it difficult for young artists to even live over here. So we'll see where that goes. There's good sides and bad sides to it, but it's become somewhat of a challenging environment for younger artists.
And that seems to be happening everywhere, really, in big cities. As soon as you know, for maybe not quite in Berlin yet, but it's certainly
right.
In New York, Brooklyn is not so
right.
expensive to live in anymore. It's just
right.
people are going further out, Jersey
right.
City and more.
I think we're on the verge of the rise of the maybe not even the second cities, the third cities or whatever. There are so many great places to live just in the United States. I mean, never mind the rest of the world. Just these amazing cities with incredible architecture, with local cultures, with universities. I spent last summer, I spent my vacation in Minneapolis, and you can still, on a lower middle class salary, afford a nice big house in a neighborhood, and it's just a fantastic place. And I just thought, why doesn't everyone just move there? I mean, it's just great.
Mm. Yeah, and it does seem that there can be an art scene almost anywhere. I was just reading...
Yeah.
About Michelle Gravner and her
yeah.
The Poor Farm and
yeah.
these kind of suburban art projects
right.
that seem viable. You know,
yeah.
it doesn't
okay.
have to
absolutely.
Be that artists must be in a major city, perhaps.
Right, right. Oh, I think that's absolutely true, and I think that Chicago, Milwaukee area, the communities that Michelle is involved with. There's a residency out there called Acre that's got some incredibly dynamic things going on. It's in the rural Wisconsin and. It's just an amazing place. There is definitely high-level culture being made in all the corners of this country, and I think that with a little imagination, which is what art folks are supposed to have, they could go just about anywhere and make something interesting happen. So I'm not totally bummed out about what's happening in places like San Francisco and New York. It is too bad because those at one point were cities which were marked by the fact that people of all classes could choose to live there, and the conversations across class and across communities was what made them vibrant, and they're becoming monocultural. So, but what can you do? I mean, go where you can make something happen.
Right. Which I mean, that's an interesting note to end this on. But in terms of direction of artists to move where there's a little
right.
elbow room and breathing
yeah.
space, in a sense,
right.
where you can not work so much to pay rent,
exactly.
but actually make art and perhaps curate.
Right, exactly. I couldn't have said it better.
Larry, thanks so much for talking with us today.
My
I really
pleasure.
Appreciate
thanks,
you.
Brainerd. Good to connect with you after all these years.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.